I want to again look at this question of why. Often, in the midst of suffering, I hear it, you've heard it, why me? Why this? Why now? And usually they say it a little bit more passionately than I do. Now, asking good questions is a good thing, because if we ask good questions, we're going to get good answers, and we'll have some conclusions for that we're asking. But remember, bad questions are going to bring about, well, in this case, just frustration. And we're not going to get very far with why. We know the reason why. Last week, as we went through the material, and especially in growth groups, you were given a sheet of about at least 11 possible lessons that God is teaching us when we go through the difficulties. But we know to a certain degree why the troubles are coming. Very, very simply, it's for His glory and for our good. And then we've unpackaged that just a little bit with 11 possible lessons. For today's sermon, I was trying to look through some of my files and come up with a snapshot of life, kind of a composite scenario, to help put some flesh and blood to the sermon outline that you have in the bulletin there. And I thought, and I was digging around, and meanwhile, the week on our end was going by, and instead of me coming up with a composite hypothetical life situation that we could use to see the interaction between the sovereignty of God and the individual and the sources of suffering in the individual, I thought there's probably no better life experience that I could use than Robin and I. So let me just give you a couple explanations. My bike was going in for just some easy electrical work, and found out that it has a blown head gasket and a few other things. So Sunday, when I was rotating Robin's tires on her Hyundai, I noticed some really bald spots on the inside of all of her really tires. So we purchased 4 new 18-inch tires, and we got a 4-wheel alignment. Thursday, as we were leaving the church to go to the gravesite for Bill Card, my car was right over there. I go to turn it on, and the thing won't start. So fortunately, they were able to move the lead car, and I just put it in neutral and released the parking brake, and it's all downhill, and rolled it around back out of there. And then Friday morning, after I made breakfast, the right front burner of the electric range will not shut off unless you trip the circuit breaker. So a tremendously huge outlay of cash has happened here in the last 5 days. We haven't replaced the stove. I mean, that's no big deal. Those are tangible, but there's also been some intangible struggles. For example, Monday, and this is even more important because money is nothing really. Monday, my father-in-law, Bob, had a stroke. And then time went by. We were praying for him on Wednesday. Thursday, he had his carotid artery cleaned out. Thursday, they thought that he might be with like a little anemic, so they were going to do a CT scan and do some blood work. And it was found out that he has a mass in both his intestines and in his lungs. So Friday, a colonoscopy was done, and surgery was supposed to be done to remove the mass, but it was too involved and too complicated. So now the surgery is postponed for Tuesday. So then today at 6:45, Robin flew out of PHL to go spend a week with her parents, and I just got a text from her a minute ago. She's safe and sound and in the car. So, as the book of James 4 says, boast not thyself of tomorrow. Thou knowest not what a day may bring forth, or a week for that matter. So pick out one of those tangible or intangible ideas, and let's, after we have a word of prayer, let's work through this material and see just how does the sovereignty of God play into how we handle and respond to trials. And even with that, then, how do at least 5 different sources from where these struggles come from, how does that play into how we respond? Because, you know, many times we shake our fist at God and say, God, why me, why this? Oh, and sometimes it's not directly from the hand of God. So in essence, kind of generally speaking, God didn't have any part of it. So it's like, what are you blaming me for? Now, before we begin to investigate the sources of suffering, you got to make sure you have a biblically accurate understanding of who God is. And the first question is God sovereign? Sovereign, control, the final authority, the one who calls the shots, the boss, if you will. Is God sovereign? I'm just going to read through these verses because I have a lot of verses and we don't have enough time. Isaiah 14:24 says this, "The Lord of hosts has sworn, saying, surely as I have thought, so it shall come to pass. As I have purposed, so it shall stand." Okay, Exodus 8, you've got the plagues going on. And we're now to the plagues of the flies. And what we see here in Exodus chapter 8, the other plagues have also affected the Israelites. Not quite yet, but they haven't gotten out of there. The slaves would be a more accurate term. They haven't become a nation yet. And what God is saying here in Exodus chapter 8, he says, listen, my people have experienced all the other plagues, but with the plague of the flies, I'm going to set apart the land of Goshen, where the slaves were living. So all the Egypt is going to experience the lice, the frogs, the blood, etc., except the land of Goshen. And in that way, God showed his sovereignty over even the natural insect, natural world, that he says, listen, you bugs can go anywhere you want, but just don't cross over this border where my people are living. In Job chapter 37, God says to the snow, fall upon the earth. Verse 10 says, by the breath of God, ice is given. So God is in control of what the unbelievers would say, Mother Nature. God is Mother Nature, and God is controlling that. Isaiah 46:10, God through the prophet Isaiah says, declaring the ends from the beginning, from the ancient times, things not done yet. God knows it all. And that's what I love about that omniscience of God. He knows everything, past, present, future. Everything that we could happen. Everything that we could do and happen. And he knows it simultaneously in just one simple act. He knows everything. And so putting it down this way, you know, for Jared, he knew that Jared could have put on 16 different color shirts, but he knew it was going to be a blue shirt. And there are several different pews that they all could have been sitting at today, which I'm glad to see all these teenagers here today. Thank you for coming. But God knew that you'd be sitting there, even though you did have some other choices. And he knew it long before the earth was ever created. And this is so amazing for me about the sovereignty of God, and we'll get to that in just a minute because I'm bleeding over into is God knowing. Daniel chapter 4 verse 35 says, all the inhabitants of the earth are accounted as nothing, and he does according to his will among the host of heaven and among the inhabitants of the earth. God has a plan, as we see in Ephesians chapter 1, verses 11, 12, and 13, and he's going to work everything to accomplish his plan, and we know how that plan is going to end as we get to the book of Revelation. In Revelation, we see how it's all going to end. So here, let me ask you a couple quick questions. Could God have prevented the head gasket from failing, the electric range to get some sort of an electronic malfunction, or the Hyundai from going out of alignment? God can do anything, but he has limited himself to operate within the natural laws that he's established. Could God have prevented my father-in-law's body being filled with cancer on both hemispheres, in the lungs and in the abdomen? Well, again, God can do anything he wants, but he has limited himself within the natural laws that he's established. So, does that give me comfort? Well, we'll see. Let's go on a little bit further. Number two there is God all-knowing. This is kind of fun. This is one of the verses why we believe that life begins at conception. This is why we are pro-life, not pro-abortion. Because Jeremiah, God is telling him, and there in 1:5, he says, "Before I formed you in the belly, I knew you. I had plans for you." He says, "I sanctified thee, and I ordained you a prophet to the nations." Isaiah 46 says, "Remember this and stand firm. Recall it to mind, you transgressors. Remember the former things of old, for I am God, and there is none other. I am God, and there is none like me, declaring the end from the beginning, and from ancient times not yet done, saying, my counsel shall stand, and I will accomplish all my purposes." God is all-knowing. Now, this is where it really comes into me as a real blessing and a real encouragement. How many of you have got GPS either on your phone or in your car? Wow, not many. Those of you that have it, do you use it? I use mine all the time. And you know why I use it all the time, especially if Rob is in the car, because then I don't have to pay any attention to where I'm going. All I have to do is punch it in, and then we just drive, and I get this little annoying voice, "Turn, turn, hey, you missed it," recalculating, and then we got to turn around. But I enjoy my GPS. I don't really have to worry about where I'm going because I got the GPS who knows where I'm going. And for me in my life, that gives me great comfort because I don't need to know how all this is going to play out. I don't need to figure out about all the expenses and even then the airplane ticket to get Robin down to Florida. I don't have to even begin to worry about what are we going to do with my mother-in-law. And now my parents, by the way, are coming on Tuesday to spend a month with me, and my dad's not in the best of health. And what are we going to do with our aging parents? And what? I don't need to know all that. You know why? God knows. He's got my GPS. He knows where it's all going to play out. I can just kind of sit back and, using a metaphor, kind of go back and enjoy the ride. Because God's going to direct my paths. Isn't that what Proverbs 3, 5, and 6 says? Trust in the Lord with all your heart. Do not lean on your own understanding. Well, it doesn't make any sense to me. Well, it's not supposed to make sense to you. In all of your ways, acknowledge him, and he will what? He'll be your GPS. He'll tell you where to turn. He'll tell you where to go. He'll tell you, what are we going to do with the mother-in-law? Is she going to live with us? Are we going to put her in some care, which already we're getting nervous about because Bob had a bowel obstruction and they gave him the milk or the liquid to drink and the nurses weren't there. And it was Disastersville, and then he has to get to the bathroom by himself, and he can't in the hospital room, and there's toilet paper, and he's naked, and it's just a horrible mess. And are we going to regulate maybe my mother-in-law or him to something like that? What are we going to do? We don't have to worry about it. God's my GPS, and that's the beauty of being a Christian. God knows. I don't need to know. It's just day by day. I got a God who is sovereign, who is controlling everything. Okay, it's all working to his own good one way or another. We'll talk to that in just a minute. And he's all-knowing. But you know what? We could all think of despots in this world, on our earth, who have been very powerful and very knowledgeable, and it has not worked well for humanity. All we have to do is go over to Europe. We could talk about Stalin. We could talk about Hitler. Go to Asia, we could talk about Pol Pot. You know, we could find all kinds of people who have been very knowledgeable, very powerful, and has not worked out very well. So then we got to come to the third one. Is God holy? And we sing some of the songs, "Holy, holy, holy, Lord God Almighty." What are we singing? Holiness has kind of a two different ideas here with this idea of holiness. Number one, it's that he's separated from all his creation. He is separated. He's not tainted with the sin-cursed effect of the earth. God is set apart. He is holy. Similar to, remember in the Old Testament, there were various instruments, there were various utensils and cups and plates that were used for God's glory. And then when he had one of those Babylonian kings, Belshazzar, he took the temple artifacts and was using them in a profane way. Then the finger on the wall said, buddy, your days are done. That's that idea of holy. God is set apart. But then there's another aspect of holiness which says he is separated then also from anything that is unethical. He is separate and holy from anything that even has the least amount of sin to it. As I'm reading through the Old Testament, I am reading about all the horrible sin that the Israelites get into, and God says, and it never even crossed my mind. God cannot even, well, think about it this way. It's not that God cannot, but God has not ever, even for a fraction of a nanosecond, ever entertained a bad thought. If he was driving this week like you were driving this week and people cut out in front of you, which still, God's still working on me there because I still have people pull out in front of me, go below the speed limit, and I look in my rearview mirror, what do I see behind me? Nothing. Nothing. Like he couldn't wait 15 seconds and then go 20 miles an hour down the road. I mean, he can do that. So you can still see God's still working on me, exposing my sin here. But God has never, ever, ever got upset in an unjust way, in an unholy way. Jeremiah 29:11, and that's one of our favorite verses where he says, I know the thoughts that I think towards you, saith the Lord. Then he goes on to define that just a little bit. These are thoughts of peace and not of evil, to give you a future, to give you an end. And then you got Isaiah and Revelation, where you've got these winged beings. And from eternity past, if we can use that idea, to eternity future, these angels or these winged beings are just crying, holy, 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 day and night, without stopping. So, as we get into the hardships of life, and we start questioning God, if we begin to think that God has done us wrong, because sometimes we do, those questions of why me, why this, why now, there's a lot packaged into those questions. And sometimes they're saying, God, you're doing me wrong. Well, when it comes to this attribute or characteristic of God being holy, the moment we start thinking that God has done us wrong, then God is sinful, which then means that God then ceases to be God. So we need to be careful as we go through the many hardships, the difficulties of life, that we believe that there is a God who is actively or allowing all of this stuff to happen, that there is a God who is knowing about this. And for me, that just takes a huge burden. I don't have to be worrying about, I'm not a prophet. By the way, we don't believe that prophecy is happening in this dispensation, but many of us are prophets, and we're thinking 3 weeks down the road, and we've got this horrible train wreck that we have put in our minds of how this is going to work 3 weeks from now, and it's sometimes a self-fulfilling prophecy as we just charge right into it. But we don't know the future. I didn't know the future. If Robin and I knew what was going to happen this week, we might have just kind of checked out. I don't know, gone down to Florida for a week or something and just let this week go by. But God knows, and he is holy. And then the next one is God loving? We don't need to spend, I don't think, a lot of time on this while we're in this building, because we all know John 3:16, for God so loved the... Okay, but what does that mean? Well, it means that he gave his only begotten son. Romans 5:8. Yeah, the next one down there. Romans 5:8. How did God demonstrate his love for us? In that while we were yet sinners, Christ died for us. Now, sitting here in the pew, we got that. We're good, okay? Let's move on. But as soon as you go outside this door, you better hang on to it again. We need to go back into, again, if nothing else, Hebrews 12, whom the Lord loves, he what? Lets him win the $200 lottery or $200 million lottery. No. Whom the Lord loves, he? Yes. So then, as we talked about it last week in our growth groups, if we had to choose just one, and you could only choose holiness or happiness, which would you choose? And if we choose happiness, then God is not going to be a loving God. If we choose holiness, then out of the 7.7 billion people that Siri said last week was on the planet as of currently, 7.7 billion people on this planet, God is taking individual time out of his infinitely busy schedule to work on you personally to help shape and mold you into the image of God. Yes, that's what we want, because we want to be holy, not necessarily happy. Now, there are points and times in our life where they converge, but even if not, we still got that joy, peace, love, gentleness, goodness, self-control that is irregardless of circumstances. Robin and I, we really had a good time going down to the airport today. How could you have a good time with all the mess that we've been through? Well, there's still that inner confidence. There's that inner joy. There's that God that we love and serve that's regardless of circumstances. Is God loving? Yes, he is. Number six, is God looking out for my best interests? Hebrews 12:11. Let me read that for you. For the moment, all discipline seems painful rather than pleasant. But later, it yields that peaceable fruit of righteousness to those who have been trained by it. Does God have my best interest in mind? Absolutely. Absolutely he does. So we have to, again, just unpackage this a little bit. So what is the purpose of life? Because that question is going to determine, do I really think that God has my best interests in mind? Because I do have a purpose for my life. So the question is really, what is the purpose of life? And then who determines purpose for life? Do I myself, Dan Scogan, get to choose my own purpose for living? Or does God get to do that? And then, let's say purpose, okay? So is the purpose of my life, as the scripture says, just wrapped up in 70, 80, 90, 20, 40, 60, plus 10 is 70 years? Or is there maybe not an eternal purpose for my life, which can continue on long after the grave? Especially me, as some of us are getting a little older and got more years behind us. Is there still yet a greater purpose for my life than just what's on this terra firma? Is there something more than just this life purpose? Is there not a greater purpose yet that will continue on for eternity? Well, then, does God have my best interest in mind? Well, it depends upon what you think your purpose in life is. If it's as the old commercial says, you only go around once in life, so get all the gusto you can, then there's probably going to be a conflict of interests. So, is God looking out for my best interest? And here's another one that we run and we struggle and we stumble over this all the time. But God, it just doesn't make sense to me. Doesn't make sense to me. But here's what Isaiah 55 says. Isaiah 55 says this, "For my thoughts are not your thoughts, and my ways are not your ways. For as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my thoughts so much higher than your thoughts, and my ways so much higher than your ways." And then Deuteronomy 29:29, that's also another verse that we don't particularly like. He says, "There are secret things that belong to the Lord God alone," period. There are some questions that you will never have answered this side of eternity. There are secret things that belong to God. But then the verse goes on to say, "But the things that are revealed to us and to our children forever, that we may do all the words of this law." So, who am I to judge the actions of God? But God, why me? Why this? Why now? God, really? Seriously? I thought it only comes in groups of three, says the superstitious. I mean, we've had one like just about every day. Like, what's going on, God? Who am I to judge the actions of God? Who am I to think that my thoughts are better than his thoughts? Who am I to think that my plans or my ways are better than his ways? as Jackie sang that song, "Thy will be done." And that's a good passage that we can't get into, but go back to the Garden of Gethsemane near the end of the time of Jesus' life. And Jesus did kind of say, you know, God, if you could let this crucifixion pass from me, he used the word cup, let this cup pass from me, said it three times, but each time he prayed that, he said, "Thy will be done." And you and I, we need to be that submissive to our loving, knowledgeable, in control, caring, best interest in mind God. All right, let's look at some suffering here. And I think we can get this through this and be out on time. Now, it is true that God uses people and circumstances to discipline his children, but not all suffering comes directly from God. Okay? So here's the first one. The first one is, yes, it does come from the hand of God. The Noahic or the Noah flood in Genesis 6. Where'd that come from? God. It was God who destroyed the earth. As you go a little bit further than that, in Genesis chapter 19 with Sodom and Gomorrah. Who destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah? God did. God did. When we get to Acts chapter 5, when Ananias and Sapphira, husband and wife, they got some property in the first century church, and I don't fully understand all of that because we know it didn't turn out very well. They went into kind of a socialistic, communal type living, and everybody was going to sell everything they had, and they were all going to kind of live equally within the church, and that went bust real quick, and then the other churches had to be giving them money from Asia Minor and other parts of the country to help bail them out because the money ran out. But Ananias and Sapphira, they had a piece of property and they sold it, but when they went to the apostles to give them the sale of the property, they lied about how much they sold it for because they wanted to keep a few shekels in their pocket. So the husband comes in and I'll just throw out an arbitrary amount. And the apostle said, "Say, you sold your property." He says, "Yes, I sold it for $300. But he actually sold it for $400. So he kept $100. And he instantly dropped dead. And by the time they dragged his feet out of the building, the wife comes in. And the apostle said, "Hey, I heard you sold your property for $300. And she goes, "Yeah, we did." She knew they were keeping $100. And bam, she drops dead. Who did that? God. God did that. And then we just read in Hebrews chapter 12, whom the Lord loves, he does chasten. Now, for me, personally, in my situation, I very much doubt that the breakdown of our transportation, all three vehicles, or the health of my father-in-law is this case from the hand of God. You could argue that back and forth, but I don't personally think it is. I think the reason it is for what we've experienced here this last week is we're just living in a broken world. When God cursed this earth, you think he was kidding? You think he did it half-hearted? I mean, God does things perfectly, right? So when God cursed this earth, how perfect was his curse? I mean, he nailed that one right on the head. There is just much suffering that comes just from living in a broken world. Genesis 3, cursed is the ground. We get to Romans 8, and in Romans 8, it talks about the earth itself, the whole planet. Again, notice, for God so loved the world. And then in Romans says, the earth groans. So the world has to do with the population, the inhabitants, mankind. But in Romans 8, he's talking about the earth, the dirt. The earth is suffering and groaning under this curse of sin. So you've got the second law of thermodynamics, which means that everything just basically continues to erode, decay, to break down. That head gasket on my motorcycle was 40 years old, exactly. 40 years old. You think that piece of cork could deteriorate just after 40 years? I'm surprised it lasted that long. Our bodies. Is it because of my father-in-law, though a recent believer, is a horrible, wicked sinner, that he got the stroke and he's got something going on below and something going on above? Or could it just be he's an 85-year-old man and he's just experiencing the curse of sin? Corruption, the sorrow, the dead batteries, the alternators, the flat tires, the termites, the cancer, and on, it all is just part of living in a broken world. There's another source as well. It's Adam and Eve. Adam and Eve. In Adam and Eve, let's look at just a couple of the verses there on the bottom, Romans 3:10. There's none righteous, no, not one. Okay? Romans 3:12. There is none that seeketh God, there's none that doeth good. Romans 3:23, for all have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God. Now, barring a little advertising tag from the Geico commercial, what do sinners do? They sin, because that's what sinners do. And many of the stuff that we are affected by, many of the stuff that comes down our path is because we're living amongst sinners. Sinners. It's what they do. So, we've got Amnon raping Tamar there in 2 Samuel 13. We've got Isaiah 53. All we like sheep have gone astray, and we have turned every one to his own way, and there's none that is righteous. There's none that seek after God. There's none that doeth good. We are in a very large population of sinners. We had the wedding on Friday, and then we had the renewal of the vows on Saturday. But, you know, anytime you get two people together living in close proximity, even as believers with that residue of sin within us, we begin to understand that it's not just coming from the hand of God. It's coming from my wife. Whew, a week vacation. Just kidding. Number four, Satan. Satan, Job chapter 1. Satan motivated a group of people to kill and to steal. He did the Sabaeans in verse 15, and he did the Chaldeans in verse 17. In chapter 1, Job harnessed the power of the storms to collapse the house on Job's children. So sometimes some of this natural destruction is not just because we're living in a broken world, and it really doesn't necessarily have to come from the hand of God. It could come from Satan. But I've said this before, and it is perplexing. Why don't we ever have people shaking their fist at Satan, saying, why are you doing this? Because from Job chapter 1, we see that he can do that. We see that there in Luke 22, where Satan entered into Judas's heart and motivated him to betray Jesus Christ. Then we have 2 Corinthians 12. The Apostle Paul has this thorn of the flesh. There is a physical ailment, and he says it's a messenger of Satan to beat me. So there's some physical affliction from the hand of Satan, if you will, given to God's children to make them miserable. So it could, yes, come from Satan. And then lastly, it can just come from ourselves. For example, and this is completely unrelated to our scenario, but if I had high blood pressure, and my doctor has been telling me a course of regimen that I must adhere to, and I don't follow it, and I have a stroke, who's to blame? Me. If I'm smoking two packs a day, and I come down with lung cancer, and again, this has nothing to do with my father-in-law. I mean, we're out of the picture here. But if I smoke two packs a day and I come up with lung cancer, who's to blame? It's me. Hey, with my automobiles, if I don't change the oil, in fact, you come to me and you say, hey, Dan, when'd you change your oil last? I go, I don't know, how old's my car? Oil? And the engine seizes up. Whose fault is it? Who's to blame? It's me. A couple weeks ago, we were driving up to New York for that ACBC Discipleship Training Conference, and we're up on the Jersey Turnpike where you got the trucks on one side and the cars on the other, and we're on this side. Doesn't matter left or right for you. And we're on this side, and there's another vehicle on this side, and it's a pickup truck, and he's got sheets of plywood in his pickup truck, and he's got the sheets of plywood up over the cab. And I'm driving this way, and I'm beginning to watch it just a little bit, and I start slowing down, and sure enough, one of those sheets of plywood went up over and smashed right down on the car following it, which is a good lesson. Pickup trucks with stuff in it, dump trucks. You never want to stay close to them anyway. Semis, you back up, but just came up right over and smashed right down on that car. Now, who's to blame? Person is. It's not an act of God or Satan's stupidity for not securing the load and not putting the plywood in this way instead of putting the plywood in this way. So, while some suffering does not at all come from the hand of God, but rather the evil and wickedness of men, and here we go, catch this now, God can take that evil and the wicked actions from the hand of God, from men, and use it for good. If you've not yet memorized Genesis 50:20, you have to. Joseph was sold into prison, accused falsely of rape, and was thrown into jail, forgotten in jail, okay? And now his brothers have come stand before him who wanted to kill him. And he looked at his brothers there and he says, "You meant it for evil, but God turned the evil that you were very much behind and were very much engaged in and very much trying to make my life miserable. God took your evil and he turned it into my good. Because I am now second of the most powerful nation in the world. And also for your good, because you don't have to starve to death." So you need to memorize that Genesis 50. While some suffering comes solely as a result of living in a broken world, the hand of God can take the brokenness of just stuff happens. I mean, how long is a head gasket supposed to last for? 45 years? 50 years? I mean, 40 years, that's a long time. But God can take the brokenness of just living in a broken world, and he can use it to accomplish his purposes, as Ephesians 1, 10 through 11 says. Because we have Jeremiah 29, 11. "For I know the thoughts that I think towards you, says the Lord, thoughts of peace and not of evil." And then lastly, just one last one, what does Romans 8, 28 say? "And we know that all things work together for good to them that love God, to them who are called according to his purposes." And then verse 29 says what that is. "For whom he foreknew, he also," anybody know the next word? "He predestined us. He has chosen us. His best interest, and should be our interest or purpose, is to be conformed into the image of his Son." So all things work together for good. So whether it's from the hand of God, whether it's from Satan, whether it's from Adam, whether it's living just in a broken world, or whether it's from my own stupidity, God is big enough and powerful enough to take all of it and turn it into good. And I love that. And I love that. Suffering's going to happen. And if you're going to get through suffering in a God-honoring and even a understand there's a difference between happiness and joy. I'm not talking about happiness. But if you want to get through it with a joy-filled way, you got to have a right view of God, and you got to understand where it could be coming from. Because you can't blame God for everything. All right?